Okay. Shavuot Tov. I'm going to move back just a little bit because this pillar is in front of me, and I assume it's doing something important, but it's still a little bit weird to look at. Okay, good evening, everybody. What I'd like to do for the next 45 minutes or so, and feel free to leave if that is far too long for you, but what I'd like to do is what I do rather frequently, actually, is try to explain some of the mechanics and some of the dynamics of Islamic law in very, very broad terms, and to do it to a Jewish audience using Jewish ideas and Jewish concepts and Jewish terminology, because those are the ideas that we have an intuitive feel for and we understand a little bit better. Then I can sort of talk about and define Islamic concepts to you. But using Jewish concepts, this can be, you can get a much more intuitive feel for what's going on. I do the same thing, by the way, with Muslim audiences. And I explain Jewish law to them and the dynamics of how Jewish communities work using Islamic terminology. I can do this both ways, by the way, as you may guess, because there's enough similarity there and overlap that the concepts often easily translate one to the other. Why exactly that is very interesting, but not for now. Maybe another time. But let's begin from the very, very beginning. Okay? Religion, our religion, their religion. Religion tends to presuppose that there's a God. That's number one. That's a pretty easy one. There's a God, and God has some sort of ideas about how human beings should live. God has a will. God has ideas about what we should be doing here, goals for us, and ideas of how to achieve those goals. Right? In our world, we could term that very broadly as Torah. Right? There's a Torah out there. God has prescribed a Torah. God has ideas about how human beings, or particularly Jews, should live and carry on their lives in order to achieve whatever it is God is aiming at us to achieve in this world. And we do so by observing the Torah. Likewise, in Islam, God exists. And God has ideas about how the Muslim community should observe and achieve their goals in this world, how individual Muslims should achieve their goals in this world, and the way of doing that is through the Sharia. Okay? Sharia literally means, if you translate it the Arabic carefully, it means a road. If you go to a Muslim country and you ask where something is, and they tell you it's on Sharia, this and that, it's on this and that road. Okay? It means a road, and particularly in early medieval or classical Arabic, in the Arabian Peninsula, it didn't mean just any road, but it meant specifically a road to water. If you live in the desert, the road to water is very, very important, because that's the only way you survive in the desert. Okay? This gives you a little bit of an inkling of sort of the idea that's being expressed by terming God's teachings or God's ideas about how human beings should conduct themselves as the Sharia. It's the way human beings make it through the parched desert of this world to some sort of proper living, salvation, eternal life in the next world. Okay? That's the Sharia. There's a very famous comment that Nachmanides makes in the mid-1200s in response to a very famous verse in Leviticus. The verse says, you should be holy. Okay? This is a very famous verse. Be holy because I, God, am holy too, so you should be holy. And Nachmanides notes that it can't be that this verse telling me to be holy is an instruction to follow the law. Other commentators think that this verse is an extra command to follow all the rules that the Torah has laid out. Nachmanides says that's seemingly and silly, that's silly and impossible. And he says that can't be what the verse means for the very simple reason that if you take any legal system, Torah included, if you just follow the rules, you can still end up a terribly dreadful and horrible person while still following all the rules. there are reasons for this, and lawyers in the room, and particularly people who are interested in legal philosophy, know all of this stuff, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail right now, but the way any rule system is formulated, it's impossible for every rule system to tell you exactly how to act in every situation in order to be good. It can set broad parameters for your behavior, and it can't really anticipate how you should act in every situation and how every individual should act in every situation, because how every situation that any particular individual encounters ever is unique. And what I should do in a situation is different from what you should do in that same exact situation. And when I encounter that situation tomorrow, the answer may be different than when I encountered it yesterday, because every case is different and every question poses a new situation. It's impossible for any rule system to give me all the instructions on how to be perfectly good and moral. And so Nachmanides says, in addition to the rules, the Torah also gives us big, broad principles like be holy. And it's basically an instruction to say, take the rules, learn from the rules, but don't just follow the rules. You also have to learn values from the rules and figure out what to do when the rules run out and how to act properly when the rules run out. And you have to also understand when a pure and direct application of the rules leads to bad behavior. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And it's impossible for the rules to tell you exactly what you should do in every situation. They can tell you what you must do. They can tell you what you cannot do, but that still leaves a wide area of what you should and shouldn't do. And Nachmanides says the Torah includes many broad principles like this. Be holy or be sanctified, do what's right and good in the eyes of God, many other similar principles that fill in the gaps of the rules. Okay? Typically, when we hear the term Sharia, at least in this country and certainly for the last 18 years or so, we hear it connected to the idea of law, Sharia law. Right? Sharia law is a very, very bad term, mostly because it makes no sense. And it conveys very incorrect ideas about what Sharia is and what this broad Islamic system of behavioral norms and standards is really all about. The Sharia does include rules, the same way that the Torah includes rules. Do this. Don't do that. If you did this, then you must do that, and so on and so forth. This act of misbehavior carries this consequence, and this is how you determine whether it was done and not done, and this is how you carry out the penalty, and so on and so forth, and this is how you should pray, and this is what you can eat and what you can't eat, and on and on and on. Lots and lots of rules. That is what we would call in Islamic jurisprudence fiqh. Fiqh literally means understanding. Okay, if we were going to translate it, it means understanding. That refers to the rules, the legal rules. We'll talk a little bit about why there's a different terminology used for fiqh, for rules of law, and the Sharia more broadly. But the very easy answer to that is because Sharia is much broader than just the rules. In addition to the rules, just like Nachmanides understood in the 13th century, very early on Muslim jurists understood that a religious system that consists entirely of rules is bad. That is not a good system for creating good moral people who think about their actions and choose carefully about how to behave as best as they can in any given situation. It must include things other than legal rules. And so they understood that it includes a branch of knowledge or a branch of practice called akhlaq, ethics, morals, that go beyond the rules and fill in the gaps that the rules leave. Additionally, a rule system in religion is largely useless unless it's based on something. This is true in Judaism. We have rule systems, but if you divorce the rule system from foundational beliefs and narratives on which from which the rule system grows out of and make the rule system make sense, then the rule system has a hard time doing any of the heavy lifting to get people to behave in a certain way and usually doesn't last very long. So in Judaism, Maimonides points out that he thinks Judaism has necessary beliefs. It's interesting just to point this out, right? Maimonides comes up with this system of 13 beliefs, fundamental beliefs of Judaism. He creates one of the first and earliest creeds of Jewish theology, which is very nice. And there are interesting reasons about him being situated in the Muslim world and why he feels the need to create this system of a Jewish theology when that wasn't really a strong emphasis of the Talmudic rabbis. But again, we can leave that aside for right now. Maimonides, very carefully in his Guide to the Perplexed, has different ways of referring to different kinds of beliefs. And when it comes to these 13 beliefs, he doesn't refer to them as true and fundamental beliefs as he does refer to certain other things. He calls them necessary beliefs. Whether they're true is besides the point. That question is not very important. Whether any of the particular 13 principles that Maimonides posits are true, he thinks they are, but their truth is besides the point. He calls them necessary beliefs. They are necessary beliefs for Judaism to make any sense. There are other beliefs and other truths that are out there, but he collates these 13 because these, he thinks, are necessary for the Judaism as a system to make any sense. Islam, likewise, posits that the Sharia includes not only law and not only ethics, but it also includes a belief system, certain fundamental beliefs without which the system doesn't make any sense. Okay, law is only part of the Sharia. It also includes values and it includes principles and it includes ethics and morals and belief systems. But for now, we're only going to focus on law. Now, I just want to point to one other important aspect of this, and that is that very early on in Islamic history, we're talking in the first couple of centuries after Muhammad dies in the year 632, Muslim scholars are debating about whether or not this system of Sharia serves any purpose. Okay? This is an important question that really anyone in any legal religious system has asked. Jewish philosophers debated this and continue to debate this, and Muslim philosophers and theologians debated this and continue to debate this. Does God say to do things because they're good, or are they good because God decides that you should do them? Put slightly differently, does it make any real difference that God told us to, on Sukkot, shake a lulav and an esrog, and these types of branches or those types of branches? Could God have instead said, shake a baseball bat and a giant pumpkin? It's an important question, and it's worth asking, because it goes to something very fundamental. Does shaking a palm branch and a citron and willows and myrtles do anything? Is there any purpose to that, or is it arbitrary? Does it serve any further purpose, or are God's commandments and God's rules just arbitrary? God said, eat cows and don't eat pork. But maybe God could have just as well said, eat pork and don't eat cows. Is there any significance to the fact that he chose one over the other? Okay. Jewish philosophers debated this, and they came up with all sorts of interesting and nuanced answers to that. Worth pointing out, Maimonides thinks that those who think that there is no ulterior purpose, further purpose for the commandments, he has very strong language. He basically refers to them as people with diseased minds. Maimonides was not fond of mincing words, and when he thought someone was wrong, he definitely said so. He thought that those who think that there's no purpose to the mitzvot are fundamentally missing something really, really important about Judaism. He thought that the mitzvot are there to serve another purpose. They are not ends in and of themselves. They're there to accomplish something. Most Muslim thinkers, most Muslim scholars came to the same conclusions about Islamic law as well as other parts of the Sharia. They thought that God commanded this and that in order to accomplish something else. These things are not sacrosanct in and of themselves. They're sacrosanct because God commanded them, right? It's sacrosanct to shake a lulav rather than a baseball bat because God commanded you to shake the lulav and not the baseball bat. So therefore, shaking the lulav is important, and it's important that you don't shake the baseball bat. But they understood that shaking the lulav is not an end. Shaking the lulav is a means. It's supposed to make you realize certain ideas or sometimes certain mitzvot. Charity is there to actually do something that's inherently good. It's not the command itself. It's the command that forces you to do something that is fundamentally a good thing to do. Muslim jurists basically came to the same conclusion. It was hotly debated for many centuries. But by the 1100s or so, Muslim jurists had come up with this system known as the Maqasid al-Sharia, which basically means the objectives of the Sharia. And they thought that all of the Sharia is there to accomplish five particular goals that God wants humanity to have. Number one, the law and ethics and beliefs and all of that stuff is there to preserve life. The law is there to preserve life because human life is valuable. The law is there to preserve religion, because specifically the Islamic religion specifically, but also monotheism more broadly. And the law is there to reinforce that and spread monotheism and observance of proper religion. Property. Property is important, and people need to be secure in their property, and the law is there to accomplish that as well. Family. Family life is important, and family is the fundamental building block of society, and therefore the law is there to preserve functional families. And finally, intellect. The law is there to make people knowledgeable and intelligent and develop their minds and human knowledge on and on and on, further and further. Those were the goals of the law. Okay? This takes on a lot of importance as the world changes, because as the world changes, and the same is true in halakha and Jewish law as well, as the world changes, and it increasingly changes faster and faster over the recent centuries, you now are often faced with questions about the law not really doing what it once accomplished under new conditions. Once upon a time, under these and those conditions, the law accomplished this particular religious good or this particular goal. Under these new conditions, the law, the particular rules of the law are not accomplishing those good objectives anymore. Now they're undermining those objectives. And then the question becomes, and it's a difficult one that we continue to struggle with, and the Muslim community also struggles with, is whether you change the law, and if you change the law, how do you change the law, and which laws do you change, and which laws don't you change, in order to be able to achieve the goals that you think the law is trying to get at. Okay? This is a complicated question, and it's hotly debated on every single issue in which it arises, but I just want to put it out there so that you understand that most generally and basically, Muslim scholars, Muslim legal scholars in particular, don't think the law is an end in and of itself. They understand the rules of the law to be means to accomplish something else out there. That's a basic and general introduction to a couple of important concepts. One other important concept I want to put out there, again, something that was debated early on in Islamic history, but gradually they settled on, consensus sort of settled on one answer. There was a debate in early Islamic history about whether actually everything is regulated by the Sharia. Okay? This is a debate in Judaism as well, by the way. Does everything implicate God's will? Does God have an opinion about everything? Maybe some things God doesn't care about at all. Maybe there are things out there that I'm free to do what I want, right? I'm free to do what I want, and God doesn't have an opinion about whether I choose A or I choose B. He says you must do A or B, and you can't do C, but A or B doesn't matter. This was true among Muslim scholars as well, and there's an important reason why this question kind of comes up, and that's because if you look at sort of the primary sources, both of Jewish law and of Islamic law, the law is limited. For most things, it doesn't give me clear answers about what to do. When the law doesn't tell me what to do, does that mean God doesn't care? Or do we start with the premise that God cares about everything and therefore I have to look at the sources to figure out what I think God wants? Those are two very different approaches to thinking about law. I'm thinking about religious law in particular. This was an issue, interestingly enough, that was a major divide between Ashkenazic and Sephardic rabbis in the Middle Ages. Ashkenazic and Sephardic rabbis fundamentally disagreed about whether or not they thought God cares about everything I do, or whether the halacha really cares about everything I do. for most of the Sephardic scholars in the Middle Ages, Maimonides, Rabbi Isaac Elfasi, and that school of thought, they generally believed that the Talmud lays out the law, and if the Talmud doesn't tell me what to do or what not to do, the halacha has no opinion. There may be other things that have opinions. Philosophy may lead me in one direction. Ethics and morality may lead me in a different direction. Religious piety may lead me in a third direction. There may be things out there in the Jewish universe that have an opinion about what I should be doing here, but the halacha doesn't have an opinion. This led to an interesting thing, which was that in the Sephardic world, halacha was a discipline, and philosophy was a different discipline, and ethics was a different discipline, and piety was a different discipline, and never the twain shall meet. What I do in my philosophical studies doesn't impact the way I analyze a question of Jewish law. And when I tell you, when I ask you, what should I do in this situation, the rabbi tells me the law, even though ethically he thinks that maybe I should be doing something slightly different. In the Ashkenazic world, this was not the case at all. In the Ashkenazic world, they thought, by and large, that in the Tosafist school in Franco-Germany in the Middle Ages, they came to the conclusion that the halacha has something to say about everything. And that meant that halacha is not just law. Halacha is philosophy, and halacha is ethics, and halacha is morality, and halacha is chassidut, and halacha is musar. Halacha is all of the disciplines that lead me to proper behavior and proper thoughts and proper actions and proper attitudes and so on and so forth. And it's all there in one big jumble, and they're very, you don't really pull them apart from each other. The same debate raged in the Islamic world in the early centuries of Islam. Ultimately, the conclusion, one school of thought developed that thought that if the Quran or the primary sources of the law don't speak to an issue, then it's a free-for-all, and you have discretion to do what you like. This school of thought was roundly rejected throughout the Sunni Islamic world and the Shia Islamic world as well. And by the 1000s, 900s, 1000s or so, vast consensus said that the Sharia has something to say about everything. It doesn't always tell me I must do this and can't do that. But they came to the conclusion that for every possible human action, there are five different values that the Sharia places on that action. It's either required, obligatory, or prohibited, I must do it or I can't do it, or it's recommended, which doesn't mean I have to do it, but I should do it, or it's discouraged, which means I don't have to not do it, but I shouldn't do it, or it's subject to considered human judgment. That does not mean it's arbitrary. That does not mean it's a free-for-all. That means people need to make a considered, thoughtful judgment about the right way to act, because making a thoughtful judgment was in itself a religious value. And so some areas were left to human judgment, but not arbitrary and capricious human judgment, religiously informed judgment. Okay. So I mentioned earlier that there's a difference between the Sharia and fiqh. Between the Sharia, this broad thing of Islamic revelation and God's will for the Muslim community, and law. And I also noted that the two words are different, and I noted the translations of the two words. The Sharia means the path to water, or the path to life, and fiqh means understanding. Okay, Muslim jurists early on came to what most of the Western world only came to realize in the latter half of the 20th century, which Jewish jurists also understood very early on, by the way, which was there's a massive epistemological gap between the way things are and the way we understand them to be. And that gap is unbridgeable. When I say epistemology, I refer to knowledge. There's a massive gap in knowledge between the way things really are and the way we can possibly ever understand them to be. Why is there that gap? Variety of different reasons, but when it comes to God's will, the reason for that gap is very, very simple and obvious. If God has something in his mind about the right way to act in this situation, there's a problem. I don't know what that is because I'm not God, and I never will be God. which is sad for me, I suppose, but it means that it's very difficult for me to ever really know what God wants me to do, because God's will is in God's mind, and my mind is here on earth, and my human mind can never wrap itself around God's mind and never get in God's mind. So how does God communicate God's will? Wild guess? This is easy. Huh? Revelation, right? God reveals, right? The same is true in Judaism as well, right? How do we know what God wants us to do? God has to reveal what God wants us to do. Depending on how you understand the early stories of the Torah, God leaves little hints about what God wants us to do in nature and in human nature and in other things, and we keep missing the hint. Eventually, God has to make it quite a bit more explicit with lightning and fire and thunder on Mount Sinai, and we still didn't really get the message so well, but whatever, that's a work in progress. The same is true when it comes to Islam. God has some ideas in his mind about how he thinks human beings should live. The only way to get that into human beings' minds is through revelation. Okay? So God has to reveal God's self or God's will to humanity. How does God do this in the Islamic tradition? Sorry? Through the Quran, and specifically through Muhammad, right? So an angel dictates the Quran to Muhammad. Muhammad, who is illiterate, can't read, can't write, listens and memorizes the Quran and communicates it to his followers, and they memorize it as well. And eventually, at the end of his life, he has the text written down by a bunch of scribes, several of whom are Jewish, which is interesting and a side point, but again, not for now. And this is how God reveals his will, or part of the way God reveals his will. There's a problem here, though. There's a gap still. What's the gap? You can take a guess. Why is there still a knowledge gap here? God has revealed his will in the text of the Quran to human beings, and human beings still don't really know what to do. Huh? Yeah, so language is a human phenomenon. Language is a human phenomenon. God doesn't speak. Commentators sort of struggle with this, and philosophers in the Jewish tradition struggle with this, as sort of, what did the revelation at Sinai possibly consist of? Because God doesn't speak. So how did God dictate the Torah or speak the Torah? Doesn't matter for now. Somehow, God injected knowledge of the Torah into the mind of Moshe and into the minds of the people, at least for the first two commandments. Somehow that happened. Okay? In the case of Islam, the revelation consists of the text of the Quran. Language is a human phenomenon, and as a human phenomenon, like all other things human, it is imperfect. It is occasionally ambiguous, or more than occasionally ambiguous. It's general, and it's vague, and it's unclear how to apply it to new situations. There's a gap here. If God is going to communicate through language, the only thing we can ever conclude based on reading Revelation, the text of Revelation, reading the Quran, we can't actually access God's mind as it is. We can only access God's mind as we understand it to be. Hence, Islamic law is not Sharia. Islamic law is fiqh. It's not God's will. It's an understanding of God's will. And this is a very, very important distinction that Muslim jurists have emphasized over and over and over and over and over again. And for some reason, it's made its way poorly into Western knowledge of Islam. Any attempt to formulate rules or express opinions about what Islamic law is understood by Muslims, mostly, to be only a human understanding, an attempt at understanding God's will, not actually God's will itself. Even if I read you a verse from the Quran, black and white on the page, the words that Muslims believe God dictates to Muhammad, and Muhammad faithfully and without any interpretation scribes, that is still only an interpretation, because the words and the symbols and the ideas that pop into my mind when I read those words are human interpretations of those of that text. So there's a gap. Okay? How do we bridge the gap? That is the entire endeavor of all of Islamic law. It's important to follow the Sharia. The Sharia is the path to water, and it matters because we're thirsty. But we have a knowledge gap, and we need to figure out how to bridge the gap. Once upon a time, it was very easy to bridge the gap. For about 22 years of Muslim history, it was easy to bridge the gap. If I needed to know what to do, I went to the Prophet. I went to Muhammad and I said, Muhammad, what do I do in this situation? And Muhammad, being a prophet, has, in whatever form or shape it is, has direct access to the mind of God and can give me an answer and tell me exactly what to do in this situation. Okay, that's helpful. Although, of course, even during Muhammad's lifetime, that's only somewhat of a stopgap because, number one, Muhammad isn't receiving revelation all the time. Number two, Muhammad isn't around all the time. Number three, as the history of the Muslim community goes on, there are different communities that are sent out to different places who don't live with Muhammad. And so they don't have this access all the time. And of course, the problem gets much, much worse because after Muhammad dies, there's no more prophet. So now all I'm stuck with is what I know from the prophet prior to his death, which all requires lots and lots of interpretation in order to be applicable. That makes the gap wider. And so Muslim jurists in the early centuries of Islam, we're talking the late 600s, 700s, 800s, start to construct a system to figure out most fundamentally how do we bridge the gap as best as we can. One of the biggest concerns here, by the way, is that they're very concerned with subjectivity. They understand that interpretation is inevitable, and we're going to figure out ways to interpret revelation in order to come to conclusions about how to act. But we need to do so in a way that avoids human biases, because all humans are biased. And even to the extent that those are not bad biases, they still color the way we read and interpret and understand things. And the Quran, and the only time the Quran mentions the word Sharia, it contrasts Sharia with another word, Wahi. Wahi means capriciousness, human arbitrariness. Sharia is the antithesis of humans doing whatever they want all the time. If that's so, they understood, early jurists, Muslim jurists understood that the fundamental essence of Sharia is a regulated way of figuring out what to do as opposed to an arbitrary way of figuring out what to do. Can't just choose what to do in any given circumstance or at any time. I have to do it in a regulated way that hopefully gets me as close as possible to God's unknowable mind as I can get. So how did they do this? First, they recognized that God has communicated his will through revelation. We've already talked about that, but they divided revelation into two different types: material revelation and rational revelation. Okay? And basically what that means is that some forms of revelation in Islam are concrete, and I know for sure that they come from God. Other forms of revelation are much more amorphous. We'll talk about how those work in just a minute. Material revelation first. Material revelation is easy. The Quran is material revelation. God needed to communicate to the Muslim community, and he did so through the text of the Quran. The text of the Quran is fixed. Once I have the words on the page, that is revelation, and I know that the words on the page are God's will. Because Muhammad is illiterate, he can't read, he can't write, he's never composed a word of anything in his life. So if these words are communicated, if Muhammad says these words have been communicated to him by God, then they've been communicated to him by God, and the words on the page are God's words. Maybe hard to figure out what they mean, but I know at least that these words, the content here, is revelatory. It's from God. It's God's mind. Okay? There's a problem with the Quran. And it's the same problem that inheres in the written Torah in the Jewish tradition. Why is the written Torah an inadequate vehicle for communicating the totality of what God wants from us? There are a lot of reasons, but any guesses? Why is the written Torah inadequate, the text of the Hebrew Bible? Let's assume it's not written by man, it's dictated to Moses by God. Still inadequate. It's in Hebrew. So let's also assume we are all ancient Israelites who all speak Hebrew natively, and we know what these words mean most of the time. Good. So number one. That's an easy one, right? Not to disparage it at all. But it's an obvious and easy one. Many times the Torah is very cryptic. and ambiguous and speaks only in very general terms. It gives me rules and it speaks only very generally. This is not a particular problem with the Hebrew language. This is just a problem with language. It's particularly a problem with legal language. Anytime I try to write a law, why do I write laws? I write laws not to control behavior that occurred in the past. I write laws to regulate behavior that is going to occur in the future. In order to regulate behavior in the future, what do I have to do? I have to write a rule that's going to capture as much of the behavior that I want to control as possible in advance, without knowing exactly what that behavior is going to be in advance. Okay? So hypothetically, if I decided one day that the belt line has become hazardous to pedestrians, I might write a rule that says no vehicles on the belt line. And I post signs on all the entrances to the belt line that say no vehicles on the belt line. What does this mean very easily? Can't drive my car on the belt line. That's good. I think that's a good rule. Can I drive my bike on the belt line? Is a bike a vehicle?
Yes.
Can my grandmother bring her electric wheelchair on the belt line?
No.
It's a vehicle, yeah? What if it's not an electric wheelchair, it's a manual wheelchair?
No, it's a manual bike.
Boy, you guys are harsh. Can my 8-year-old daughter bring her remote control car on the belt line? Good. So we are all very fine draconian interpreters of this law. You may be right on the interpretation of the rule, but what does this tell me?
There are many.
This is a bad rule. Okay? This is a bad rule because what did I want to do with the rule? I wanted to protect the pedestrians on the Beltline. Certainly I need to keep off cars. Maybe I need to keep off bicycles or impose a speed limit on bicycles or something like that. I don't need to keep grandma's wheelchair off the belt line, but I didn't really think hard and long. Right, some grandmas, I understand. Some, okay, but not mine. I didn't think good and hard enough about what sort of situations might present themselves on the belt line. And so I wrote a shoddy rule, okay? Now, even if I thought long and hard about this, what would I still not end up doing? I still wouldn't have formulated a rule that covered all the future circumstances that I might have considered. Okay? Now, what I might do to try and capture as many circumstances as I might, as I can come up with, is I might write a very general rule, because general rules capture many circumstances, right? I can't write a rule that lists every vehicle out there and says whether it is or is not allowed. This would be cumbersome and unuseful. So I write a general rule that says no vehicles on the belt line. But now we understand the drawbacks of no vehicles on the belt line. It doesn't really get me what I want to do. So there's a problem with general rules, and this is an easy one because this is a fairly straightforward one, at least in terms of meaning. Okay, we can argue about which of these things are considered vehicles or not vehicles, but I know what a vehicle is. Okay, what about a rule that says do justice or be holy? I don't even know what that means. Forget applying it to new situations and unforeseen circumstances. I don't even know what sanctity and holiness and be right and good in the eyes of God actually means. And that's inevitable because I want these types of rules and principles to capture lots of stuff. So they have to be general. That's one problem why the Torah and any text or any legal text can only do so much work in advance. What else? Why else can the Torah get me where I need to go? I flew on an airplane recently and I wanted to know how to pray on the airplane. Can the Torah tell me how to pray on an airplane? Why? There were no airplanes, right? It would be very silly for the Torah to include about how to pray on an airplane. People would look at that book and say, this is bizarre, and would ignore it. God writes a book, as many of our early commentators note, God writes a book for the people that he's writing to, and later people have to interpret what that means in their context. But God writes the book for people living in 1500 BC, not for people living in 2018. So the book says nothing about how to pray on an airplane, or whether I should ban the internet or not ban the internet, or whether turkeys are kosher. It doesn't say anything about any of these things. Okay? Because, again, contextually, it just couldn't say anything about these things. They weren't around. Inevitably, then, the Torah includes too little law. Not enough law to cover all the situations. And by the way, even all the situations that would have arisen back then, it couldn't cover, because that book would be really, really big, and no one could actually make it usable. At the same time that I have too little law, and that means there are cases and questions that are not answered by the text, as I try to answer those questions by adding more rules into the book, I end up with a different problem, and a little bit of a catch-22. As I have more rules and more standards and more principles, I get the problem of having too much law. When I have too much law, I end up with contradictions and tensions within the text. And if you want to tell me that a God-written text doesn't have tensions and contradictions, you may be right, but they certainly appear like tensions and contradictions, and the rabbis certainly thought so. That's why there's an entire discipline called Medrash, which is in resolving all of these strange textual foibles and tensions and contradictions within the text. That's precisely what the entire project of rabbinic interpretation is all about. From the rabbinic perspective, we assume the text is a coherent and unified whole, and therefore these textual weirdnesses are there to signal something to me. I have to grab some meaning here to explain it, and now I've drawn more meaning out of the text by explaining the contradiction. But the contradiction is there. And it's there inevitably, because as I add more stuff to the book, those things will be in tension with each other, especially as I try to apply them in future cases that were unanticipated by the book itself. I'm going to have different things that point me in different directions. Okay? Why else is the book ambiguous and unclear? Okay, one final one. Certain words, we sort of discussed this already, but certain words are just completely unintelligible. I don't know what in the world totafot are. Now I do, because the rabbis have told me that totafot are little black leather boxes that you wrap on your arm and you put on your head when you pray. But the word totafot in the Torah means nothing. There is no translation for it, because phylacteries is just a silly word. No one knows what that means, but there is no word, there is no translation. No one knows what totafot are, absent some sort of rabbinic interpretation of the word. And there are many other such words in the Torah. If we go from the Torah to the Quran, all of this is true. Has anyone read the Quran, or parts of the Quran? Okay. What immediately strikes you by reading the Quran? The Quran is not a book like the Torah. Okay? It does not read like the Torah. It certainly does not read like the legal parts of the Torah. In fact, the Quran, which has 6,200 verses in it, 6,206 verses in it, has, depending on how you count them exactly, between 300 and 500 verses that have any legal content in them at all. Okay, very, very little bit of law. Okay. And lots of stuff you should expect it to cover, because it's a religious law system, like how to pray and stuff like that, is not in there at all. Okay? Very basic stuff. It's just totally absent. Most of the Quran reads something like prophets. It's big, bombastic type preaching. That's most of the book. Some of it is narrative, reads sort of like Genesis, but most of it is reads like the later prophets in the Hebrew Bible, and is just these big prophetic visions and preaching and exhortations to do the right thing and so on and so forth. Very, 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 very little law. Okay? Very little law means that if I just have a Quran, I don't really have much of a fixed system, and I don't really know what to do very often. And I don't know what to do about very fundamental things. Of the law that the Quran includes, a lot of it is super vague. Do justice. Okay? Lots of it sounds like that. Pray, and that's it, okay? And of the law that's in there, it's often contradictory. Pray 2 times a day, pray 5 times a day. Pray in the morning, in the afternoon, and the night, 3 times a day. How many times am I supposed to pray? I don't know, I have 4 different verses telling me 4 different things, okay? What does prayer consist of? Totally absent. Ambiguity, aside from just the not having enough law. So interesting little tidbit in Arabic, in medieval Arabic, that's worth noting. In Hebrew, There's a very clear way to tell me that I should do something. Okay? If I want to say, you shall, or you must do this, or you must not do that, there is a very easy and clear-cut verb conjunction that I use in order to tell me that. I put a tuf at the beginning of the word, and this says, do this. Not optional, do it. And if I want to tell you not to do something, I say, lo ta'aseh, whatever. And I add the negative with the tuf at the beginning of the word, and I now have an imperative verb that says, do this or don't do that, not optional, you must or must not do this. In Arabic, there's one verb conjunction. It's called the amr. The amr is used for should, shouldn't, must, need to, maybe, kind of, good idea, not good idea. And there's actually no clear-cut way of knowing which what sort of command any verb is giving you. Am I supposed to do this? Must I do this? Can't I do this? Not so clear. Very strange. Lots of ambiguity. And of course, the Quran is a book that's being revealed to Muhammad in context and only covers so much. Okay? It needs to be supplemented. In the Jewish tradition, how do you supplement the written Torah? The oral Torah. The oral Torah supplements the written Torah. The rabbis understood that you can't just have a written Torah. It makes no sense and doesn't work. God also reveals an oral Torah to Moses at Sinai and over the course of the years in the wilderness. And that oral Torah continues to be developed by the rabbis through history. The oral Torah is basically the core of the oral Torah is grounded in revelation from God to Moses. And it consists of explanations and qualifications and elaborations on the text of the Hebrew Bible. So now I know what a lot of this stuff means because I have an oral Torah. I know what totafot are because God tells Moses what totafot are, and Moses passes it down and so on and so forth, and we know what they are. Okay? The same is true in the case of Islam. There must be an oral tradition accompanying the written text of the Quran. The oral tradition is known as the Sunnah. The Sunnah literally means the right way to do things. And it refers specifically to the way that Muhammad conducted himself while acting in a prophetic capacity during his lifetime. Okay? Doesn't mean everything he did. The current Wahhabist sect of Islam, centered in Saudi Arabia, tends to think that everything Muhammad ever did is therefore good. Okay, and therefore we should dress like him, and our beard should be cut the same way as his beard, and so on and so forth. And this was not the view of Muslim jurists until the mid-1700s. Muslim jurists until the mid-1700s thought that what you're supposed to do is the behavior, the actions, the teachings, the rulings of Muhammad in acting in his prophetic capacity are normative, are law. Why are they law? Because of an Islamic concept called isma. Isma means that when God chooses someone to carry his message to human beings, he only chooses people that are going to actually carry the message properly. He doesn't choose people that are going to set a bad example for human beings. And therefore, either God is the marionette, is the puppeteer, and Muhammad is a marionette, and God's pulling the strings and making sure Muhammad doesn't make mistakes when acting as a prophet, or God knows that Muhammad would act properly when as a prophet, and therefore he chooses him rather than someone else. Doesn't matter which one of those is true. It's sort of a distinction without a difference. But at the end of the day, the result is that Muhammad's behavior in a prophetic capacity is a form of revelation. It's confirmation that this behavior, this idea, this rule is the rule that God wants being communicated. It's identical with what God likes. Okay? And so you have this other body of norms and standards called the Sunnah, which tells you what Muhammad says and does and thinks and teaches and rules and acts are part of the Sharia. This is great and very helpful. Still has serious drawbacks. Number one, the same drawbacks that apply to everything else. Well, for some, most of them. Number one, Muhammad can't tell you how to pray on an airplane because Muhammad never saw an airplane. And he never did anything about an airplane, never taught anything about an airplane, never had any idea that airplanes would ever exist. And therefore, the Sunnah only takes me so far. Okay. Another problem, the Sunnah is by definition contextual. Okay. It's Muhammad's behavior in a context tells me what rule is being done or communicated. Okay. Therefore, I need to know what the context was. the only way to know what Muhammad did or said in any given circumstance is either I had to have been there, or I had to have heard what happened from someone who saw it happen, or who heard from someone, who heard from someone, who heard from someone who was there when it happened. If context is very important, we have a little bit of a problem, because different people who were there are going to think different parts of what they saw were more or less important. Okay? Classic example. There's a dispute. There's a dispute about, in order to pray in Islam, you have to wash before you pray. There's a dispute, a famous juristic dispute, about whether you're supposed to wash before you pray while you're traveling. Okay? Why wouldn't you wash before you pray when you're traveling? Because there's a tradition that Muhammad was traveling in the desert with a bunch of followers, and it came time to pray. And they're in the middle of the desert, so they're carrying water with them, but he doesn't use the water. He wipes his hands with sand, and then he prays. Okay. This is consistent with a Quranic rule that actually specifically legitimates wiping yourself with sand rather than using water. But the question then becomes, why did Muhammad wipe his hands with sand rather than using the water he was carrying? Because he did, in fact, have water. Some narrations of this story say that he used sand and not water because there wasn't enough water and he didn't want to risk running out of water in the desert. Other traditions say that they actually had plenty of water and he washed with sand rather than water because there's a general blanket rule that when you're traveling, you don't need to use water. This makes a big difference because if I'm traveling on an airplane, there's plenty of water for everybody, unless we get stuck on the tarmac for 40 hours. But otherwise, there's plenty of water for everybody, and I can wash with water, no problem, and we won't run out. Should I wash with water or not? Must I wash with water or not? According to the first version of the narration, the same exact tradition about what Muhammad did and how he acted in a given circumstance, what do? I should wash with water because you only don't wash with water in the desert when you need your water to drink, otherwise you're going to die. But according to the second version of this story, when I'm on an airplane, I am traveling. And travelers are exempt from washing with water, period, because it's inconvenient or a variety of other reasons. And so instead of washing my hands with water, I'll rub them on the back of the seat. It's abrasive. We have the same rule in Jewish law, by the way, as well. So it's just worth pointing out. Okay, this matters. And the more people who are present in a given circumstance, the more people you have who are understanding the circumstances differently and are communicating those circumstances as an essential part of the rule, and now you have massively different rules floating around based on the same story. It gets worse, though. Very soon after Muhammad dies, when people start considering his behavior to be normative and an important source of law and rules, you know what is really inconvenient to do? If I want to do X, Y, or Z, I should make up a story where Muhammad said to do X, Y, and Z and legitimate doing X, Y, and Z. And guess what? He's not around to contradict me because he's dead. And that's what I'm going to do. And very, very soon after, the Muslim world, by the way, after Muhammad dies in 632, it lasts in some level of unity for about 20 years. And then it ends up in a series of civil wars that last four centuries with very short periods of peace in between them. There is no unity in the Muslim world within 20 years after Muhammad is dead. And when you have factions, religious factions and political factions and class factions fighting over who's the real heirs of the Muslim leadership, what do they start to do? They start to make up stories of the Sunnah to justify their leadership. And by the early 800s, so 150 years after Muhammad is dead, or so 160 years after Muhammad is dead, you have accounts of scholars who go around the Muslim world collecting hadith, collecting these narrations, these traditions about the Sunnah, about what Muhammad did or said. And they're going around, and these are all orally transmitted, by the way, similar to the oral Torah tradition until eventually they get written down. They're going around the Muslim world collecting as many of these traditions as they can because, again, they're not in books. So the only way you can get them is from people who have heard them from their parents or their teachers and so on and so forth. And different parts of the Muslim world had different followers and companions of Muhammad living there. So you get different stories in different parts of the Muslim world. And they go and they travel around and they are picking up hundreds of thousands of hadith. hundreds of thousands of individual stories about Muhammad's behavior. 100 years later, Muslim scholars decide that they need to write all of these down because it's just become too much, and they have to, and there's too much chaff in there, too much fake stuff in there. And so they start writing them down, and they start deciding which ones are accurate and which ones are not accurate. And they write six books that are kind of, six different scholars write six different books collecting what they think are the authentic version, the authentic stories. Total of about 15,000 individual accounts of the Sunnah. 15,000 individual stories about Muhammad's behavior out of something like 700,000 that are floating around at the time. So that's the vast majority are they consider to be fake. Just to give you a sense of how much fake stuff is being made up. And also, this is a game of telephone. If we're doing this orally, different people are going to pick up different nuances and different tones, and the stories morph over time. Okay, so this is another big problem, and it's a different problem from the Quran. When I have a text of the Quran and I have a verse of the Quran, I know at least that this is revelation. I may not know exactly what it means. It may be ambiguous, and I may be unsure about how to apply it to this situation, but I know that it's the Sharia. Okay, don't know exactly what it means, but I know it's the Sharia. When you tell me Muhammad did X, Y, and Z, I don't even know that this is a form of revelation. I don't know what it means either, because I have to interpret the context and figure out exactly what I think the rule is here. But I don't even know whether this is true or not. And I have to create an entire discipline, a complicated discipline that's far from foolproof, in order to decide whether a particular story is accurate or not accurate, and whether I should rely on it or not rely on it. Anyone who's been paying attention to like any media, I guess, for the last 20 years, has heard lots of things about hadith that say this and hadith that say that. All of these 700,000 fake hadith that were floating around the Muslim world, they still float around the Muslim world. Okay, and they float around the Muslim world for a variety of reasons. The most reliable ones are used for law. When I'm going to say you must pay, A must pay B money based on this hadith, I have to be really sure that it's accurate, because otherwise I'm stealing from A and giving to B. If I say that you've committed a sin and you must be punished, I'm going to whip you or I'm going to stone you. I will talk about that in a little bit. But I must do something bad to you. I must be really, really, really sure that it's justified. So only the most authentic hadith were ever used for law. But all of the other stuff out there was preserved for homiletic purposes. Because when I want to give a really good, fiery sermon, it's great to have all of this stuff to pull on. And it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. The idea is nice, and it gets me where I'm trying to go, and people pay attention and their ears perk up. So this stuff remains in circulation, and there's lots of it that's floating around that's just not actually taken seriously in a normative legal sense. Important point just to be aware of. That's material revelation. Okay, I have the material of the Quran. I have the material of the hadith, which eventually are written down in books. And I look at that and I try to figure out what it means. Separate from that, there's rational revelation. Okay, even the Quran and the Sunnah together only get me so far. Number one, because the text of the Quran, it's helped along by the Sunnah, but not enough. Still ambiguity, still contradiction, still not enough law, so on and so on and so forth. And the text and the hadith as well, we've talked about all the problems that go on there as well. So what do I need to do with all of that stuff, all of that material? I have to interpret it, and I have to analyze it, and I have to synthesize it. That discipline in and of itself, analysis, reasoning, is a third source of Islamic law. Reason, human reason. This was hotly debated in the early centuries of Islam, but by the 900s, it's generally accepted that certain forms of tightly regulated logical reasoning are a form of revelation, because God has implanted reason in us. And therefore, when we use reason and apply reason to revelatory materials in order to reach conclusions, that itself is a form of revelation. Okay, and the most classic sort of form of this type of reasoning, aside from sort of interpreting texts the way we typically interpret texts, is analogical reasoning, drawing analogies. The classic form of analogy, and just to sort of highlight the point, and with that I'll move on, the classic form of analogy is about the question of whether alcohol, hard alcohol, is prohibited in Islam. The Quran prohibits the consumption of wine. People know that alcohol is prohibited in Islam. The Quran actually doesn't prohibit the consumption of alcohol. The word that's used is khamr. Khamr, for those who know Aramaic, khamr is wine. Okay? The Quran prohibits the consumption of wine, and early Muslim jurists who, for all good sorts of reasons, and I understand the desire, wanted to know whether they could drink their Glenlivet. And so, what did they do? Glenlivet is undetermined. We don't know whether we can drink our scotch or our bourbon or our sake or our beer. Maybe the Quran only prohibits wine, and then we can drink all these things. Or maybe the Quran is prohibiting something broader. So how do you figure it out? Well, we try to go back to the rationales, right? The maqasid ash-shari'a. What is the law prohibiting wine trying to accomplish? Maybe wine is prohibited because it's wet. If wine is prohibited because it's wet, can I drink whiskey? No, because whiskey is wet. But of course, that doesn't work because what else is wet?
Water,
and water is perfectly permitted. So that can't possibly be the reason why wine is prohibited. Maybe wine is prohibited because it's purple. In which case, can I drink my whiskey?
Yes,
unless it's very strange whiskey. I can drink my whiskey. Can that be the reason why wine is prohibited?
No.
Why?
You get white wine.
Yeah, you can get white wine. Wine blanket is prohibited, and it can't therefore be that it's only that purple is the reason why wine is prohibited. Maybe wine is prohibited because it comes from grapes, in which case I can drink my whiskey. Is that the reason why wine is prohibited? Can't be. Why? You can eat grapes and you can drink grape juice. And you can pop the grape in your mouth and suck the juice, most fundamentally. And therefore, it can't be because it's a grape product. And so the jurists conclude, why is wine, again, based on other indications, but why is wine prohibited in the Quran? Because it intoxicates. Intoxicants, therefore, is the prohibition. Wine is just a specific instantiation of the real rule. The real rule is don't become intoxicated or don't drink intoxicants. Therefore, I can't drink my whiskey. That is classic analogical reasoning, taking the law that I know and using it to figure out cases that are not provided for by the actual text, by the material sources. Okay? And that's a process called ijtihad. Ijtihad comes from the same root as the word jihad. Jihad, jahada, which is the Arabic root word, means what?
Struggle.
Struggle, but something more particular than that. It's not just struggle like sometimes I try to open the top of a jar and that's a struggle. It's not that kind of struggle. It's struggle to the utmost effort for a godly purpose, or to establish godliness or God's dominion in the world or the right order of things in the world. It's a very particular meaning. So when we speak about jihad, this means violent warfare in order to accomplish, right? I'm working hard at it. It's not like lackadaisical warfare, like, you know, whatever, where I'm going to, like, use a drone and I get to sit in a comfortable trailer in Las Vegas and pilot my drone and drop bombs. It's not that kind of warfare. It's hard warfare, and I try as hard as I can in order to fight a war in order to establish the right order of things in this world. Because you fight a war when things are not the way they should be, so you fight a war to create the right kind of order. Ijtihad is doing the same thing in the intellectual context. Trying as hard as I can, using my mind and using interpretive tools and using reasoning and so on and so forth to figure out the law, because the law is how we establish the right way of doing things in the world. Okay? That's ijtihad, that's the third source. Now, there's a problem with this. As anyone who has ever engaged in interpretation and anyone who's ever studied anything in Jewish law, which is heavily dependent on interpretation as well, what happens when people start interpreting things? Yeah, they all disagree with each other. Because you interpret one way and I interpret a different way, and I see these factors as predominant and you see different factors as predominant. Maybe you think the prohibition on wine is about drinking intoxicants, while I think the prohibition on wine is about being intoxicated. Those are two very, very different things, neither of which is obvious either way from the text. Can I drink a little bit of my whiskey? I know I can't drink a little bit of my wine because wine is blanket prohibited by the text. But maybe I can drink a little bit of my whiskey because the prohibition is on intoxication. And if I only drink a little bit of whiskey, or for some of us, a little bit more whiskey, I still won't be intoxicated and I'll be fine. In which case I should be able to drink it. On the other hand, if the prohibition is don't drink intoxicants, That's a very different rule. Both of those are interpretive, and neither of them is determined by the text. Could go either way, and so we're going to disagree. And many, many, many other things we're going to disagree about. Everything is a disagreement. Yes?
We never had alcohol level detectors those days.
Huh?
We never had the device they use today to detect how much alcohol you were.
No, that's correct. But they understood what it meant to be drunk. That's sort of obvious. And it's not about, they know that a drink includes is intoxicating, and they know that drinking a little bit of it is not going to do anything to you, but drinking a lot of it is going to do something. Okay, so we disagree. How do we figure out what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to act if there are a million different opinions out there, as there were a million different opinions about pretty much every issue? By the 900s or so, there are approximately 300 different schools of Islamic law floating around out there. Schools of law meaning totally different methodologies and ways of thinking about how to think through and interpret the law. Think Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel writ large. Okay, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Hasidim and Misnagdim, Modern Orthodox and Ultra Orthodox, and Conservative and Reform, every different way of thinking about and analyzing the law, all floating around at one place. And if I want to know what to do, I don't really know what to do, because there's lots and lots of different opinions out there. There's a fourth source that helps resolve this to some extent, and that fourth source is known as Ijma, or consensus. This is based on a verse in the Quran that says, my community will never agree on an error. If my community will never agree on an error, I know that when my community agrees, they've agreed on something that is right. When there's consensus on an issue, I now know that this is a form of revelation. God is telling me that this is right. Some of the early jurists kind of had snide ways of commenting about this, and they said, if you can ever get everyone to agree on something, it's clear that God is speaking. Or it could only happen because of God's intervention and things like that. We can relate.
Crowdsourcing.
Huh?
Crowdsourcing.
So the fourth source that helps us cut through disagreement is consensus. When there are lots of different opinions, but gradually over time, everyone agrees that one of these opinions is particularly correct. Now I know that that's the right view, and the other views are wrong. Now, there's a problem with consensus also, and this makes it hard to apply in practice and makes it very unuseful at all, and that is there's no consensus about what consensus is. If you ask me whether consensus is about all the Muslims or just the scholars or only a particular quality of scholar, or it's about which issues there can be consensus on and which issues there can't be consensus on, whether there can be consensus after there's been disagreement, because maybe the existence of disagreement at one point in time indicated a consensus to disagree, which can't be then be overridden by a later consensus that knocks out previous opinions that were out there. Can there be disagreement once there's been a consensus? Because sure, when there's a consensus, that's the rule. But as soon as someone disagrees with the consensus, there's no more consensus, and maybe therefore disagreement is now legitimate again. Muslim jurists were all over the place on these questions. And this made it very hard to actually have consensus on anything, because no one could really agree about what consensus consisted of. Muslim jurists periodically tried to count up the issues about which they thought there was real, genuine consensus. The numbers varied between 3 and 13 issues on which they thought there was actual consensus. And that was it. In a massively large legal universe that's supposed to regulate every aspect of life, we can agree on 3 or 13 issues, and that's it. So consensus doesn't get us very far, at least real consensus. But what the Muslim jurists decided was that real consensus never exists, but soft consensus can exist. Gradually, schools of thought developed where large groups of people thought that this scholar's methodology of interpretation is very persuasive and good. And his conclusions are therefore very good. And he gathers lots of students, and those students have students. And gradually over time, you coalesce into a school of thought that follows particular methodology and interpretation and ijtihad, and follows particular understandings of the rules themselves. And that's not everybody, but that's a group, an identifiable group that all agrees that this is the right way to do things. By the 1200s, there are 4 such groups in the Sunni Muslim world. And they're all, as a result of this idea of ijma, understood to be legitimate. If you went to any city in the Muslim world in the 1200s or 1100s or really any time up until the Ottoman Empire becomes powerful in the mid-1500s, you went to a city, the city had at least four courts in it, four court systems, one for each school of law. And depending on which school of law you adhered to, you went to resolve your cases and your disputes in the courts of that school of law, and all of those were recognized by the local government. And sometimes, when there was a hard question that was inadequately resolved by one school of law, they would go to a different, the judges of one school would send you to the scholars of a different school who they knew had the tools and the doctrines that could solve that problem better. I'll end with this point because this is just an interesting parallel. One of the common issues where that was done was a Muslim version of the Aguna problem. Okay, in Islamic law, like in classical Jewish law, the only way a couple can be divorced, men can have more than one wife, women can only have one husband, therefore, husband refuses to divorce a wife. There are ways of dealing with it. Once upon a time, a Jewish court beat you up until you died or gave in, and that solved the problem. But what happened when you went on a business trip and you disappeared? You never came back. And now no one knows whether you're alive or you're dead. If you're alive, this woman is married and can't remarry without a divorce. If you're dead, she can remarry, but nobody knows. This was a common problem in the Muslim world as well, where likewise, divorce had to be initiated by the husband and couldn't be executed by a court. Well, the schools of thought actually disagreed about this issue. There was one school of thought known as the Hanafi school of law that held that a court, a Muslim, an Islamic court, can judicially annul a marriage under very specific certain circumstances, one of which was the disappearance of the husband for a particular period of time, therefore he's not meeting his marital obligations of spousal support and so on and so forth, and therefore the marriage is a sham and therefore we can dissolve it. No other school of law thought that that was a doable thing. But what typically happened was if you had a woman who was an adherent of one of the other schools and she went to her rabbi and said, "Rabbi, my husband's been missing, I don't know where he is, and I'd like to get remarried." And her rabbi, under his rules of thought, or her mufti, under the rules of his school, would have to say, "So sorry, can't help you, because we can't annul marriages. Husbands have to divorce wives. Courts can't annul marriages." Typically, what would happen instead was her mufti would then send her, "Go to the Hanafi judge down the street. He can help you out." And she would go to the Hanafi judge, and the Hanafi judge would convene the court, and they would listen to the case and decide whether or not they could annul the marriage under their own rules. But it was a conceivable possibility. Okay? This was the standard way of doing things in the Muslim world until the mid-1500s. In the mid-1500s, the Ottoman Empire becomes powerful. The Ottoman Empire decides that the best way to run an empire is to have only one law system in your empire. And so they abolish the other three schools of law. They adopt the Hanafi school as the official school of the empire. And that creates a whole set of interesting developments that we're not talking about now, thank God. That is, I hope, a basic overview of how this system works. It's a complicated system. It's a very undetermined system, very fuzzy at the edges, where very, very little is actually clear. And jurists working in the classical model of Islamic law recognize that things are unclear and recognize that their opinions are typically opinions, not the law itself and not God's will. And what I'm willing to do based on my opinion and what sort of things I'm willing to impose on people based on my opinion depends on how strongly my opinion is grounded in something that I think is solid and reliable. So, with that, if there are questions, I'm happy to take questions, but I'm also happy to take questions after if people want to go.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi Dr. Pill. Let's do three questions or four questions with everybody around, and then we'll officially close out, and then whoever would like to stay and ask questions, as long as Rabbi Pill can stay, can ask. So just take a few
questions. Okay, one. So, I was asked what the Quran says about Ishmael. Specifically, do you have anything specific in mind? He's a son of Avraham. He is loosely understood to be some sort of patriarch of the Arabs. not really in any strong sense understood to be a patriarch of the Muslims as a whole. Not particularly strong about that. One of the famous sort of points about Yishmael, which may or may not, which people are probably familiar with, is that there's a Muslim belief that the sacrifice of Isaac was actually the sacrifice of Ishmael. This is not true. The Quran is silent on this issue. The Quran records that God speaks to Abraham and tells him to sacrifice his son, and he goes ahead and does so, and then God, the angel intervenes, and so on and so forth. The same story as we have it pretty much in the Chumash. The son is never named in the Quran. The commentators, medieval commentators on the Quran, disagree about whether the son is Ishmael or Isaac. Most early commentators, the consensus was until about the 1600s, the consensus of commentators was that it was Isaac. It's much more recent, and it's in fact has become much more popular that the son was Ishmael, but the consensus from about 1,000 years was that it was Isaac. Although not universal, there were commentators who thought it was Ishmael all along and vice versa. That's a hard one. I would say the second part is much, much harder. The first part is relatively easy. So I mentioned that there are basically four schools of Sunni Islamic law. One of those schools, two of those schools actually, but one in particular, were centered geographically in the early centuries of Islam in Arabia. And they tend to reflect Arabian culture, Arab culture more. Those two schools of law are known as the Maliki school and the Hanbali school. The Maliki school was centered in Medina and basically took as its guiding principle that whenever the Quran or the Hadith are unclear, we should do what the people of Medina do. The minhag of Medina is what we should practice. And therefore, as a result, the law looks in that school of thought tends to look pretty Arab because that's the culture. The Hanbali school grows up in the Arabian Peninsula as well and stays there as well. The Maliki school is extremely small. Nowadays, it's extremely small. It was never very big, primarily because it was geographically centered in Medina, and therefore its rules tended to be unworkable in other places, especially when it came to matters of civil law and financial law. If you're not going to acknowledge differences in commerce and culture and ways of doing business, the law doesn't really have a lot of traction elsewhere. The Maliki school today is the smallest of the four schools of law, relatively few adherents, mostly centered in Indonesia, but relatively few adherents. The Hanbali school, which was once upon a time the smallest, is now quite a bit larger because a variant of it was adopted by the Saudi Wahhabists in the mid-1700s. And as a result of that connection, it's morphed into something that is very, very, very Arab-centered, Arabic-centered. The other two schools of law, the Hanafi school, which is by far the largest, probably 65-70% of Muslims are adherents of the Hanafi school, and the Shafi'i school are very much not Arab at all. The Shafi'i school develops primarily in Central Asia. The Hanafi school develops in Persia and Turkey and South Asia, India and those areas, and spread elsewhere. Neither of those are particularly Arab influenced. Three. So that's true, but as a caveat to that, I will say that the rules adopted by Muslim majority states in various parts of the Muslim world have very little to do with classical Islamic law. They're often drawn on or derived from particular opinions in classical Islamic law, but the classical system of Islamic law was There are hundreds and hundreds of opinions out there, and people practice the way they practice. Traditionally, until the Ottomans, and increasingly less so after that, there was actually a very strong separation between religious law and state law. The state made its law based on public policy and what it thought was necessary to make the country run well. And that had little to do with religion. And the scholars, acting separate from the state, made the religious law, and people observed it or didn't observe it. Now, since religious law was an important part of how society was organized, you could take a judgment from a religious court and get it enforced by the state. But that's not the same thing as having the state decide which religious law is legitimate or not legitimate. So you have to be kind of cautious about speaking in terms of modern states having religious practices imposed by the state. But this is similar to the way the Israeli rabbinate functions. If you're going to ask me a question about conversions, or you're going to ask me a question about gittin, divorce, or you're going to ask me a question about kashrut, my answer is very, 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 very different than the policy of the Israeli rabbanut, probably. Mostly because I don't think there needs to be an answer the way the rabbanut needs an answer, because the rabbanut is part of a state bureaucracy that has to have a policy, and this is the way it's done by the state, and religion functions outside of that. Do we want to...
Let's do two more?
You choose. I don't want people to be angry at me. Let them be angry at you. The question was about whether or not Muhammad had female disciples, and I guess more broadly, sort of what role women scholars and leaders have played in Islamic law. It's hard to say that Muhammad had disciples. Is a hard word to use about Muhammad. The way classically Islamic thought divides people is whether they interacted directly with Muhammad or not. So women did interact directly with Muhammad, and there are women who narrate traditions of the Sunnah that they experienced and saw. We asked him this question, and he said this, particularly among his family, but even broader than his family. You don't really have a sense that there are people who are scholars until the centuries afterwards, when there's something to be scholarly about, right? When there's a prophet, you don't really need scholars. There are scholars in the centuries afterwards, and there are prominent women scholars that are floating around. Depending on which parts of the Muslim world you're in and which times you're in, there are more or less Muslim scholars, and they do what they do more or less publicly. But there are many, many prominent Muslim scholars who are women. But most of those, until the relatively modern era, is sort of by narrative record. Meaning, we know this person exists, and we know she had students, and we know she taught this and that. But there are no books that she wrote that survive, and so she doesn't feature prominently in discourse in the actual legal discourse, because all we have is unconfirmed records about what she taught or what she ruled in this situation or that situation, until really the modern era. The vast majority of Muslim scholarship literature doesn't exist anymore. It's huge and voluminous, the amount of scholarship that was produced in the Muslim world on law. And the vast majority of it was just not reproduced, and it fell away, and books disappeared and were destroyed over time. So it could be that they did write books, but it was only the books that were seen as really, really important and core that actually survived. And from the classical period, there really aren't any by women. But there definitely were, and acknowledged by nowadays, that there certainly were women doing scholarly work then.
All right, we'll do one more question.
One is, nowadays we're hearing more.
That's cheating. Sorry.
Try to follow Sharia law, but there's so many schools of Sharia law. What does that really mean? And from everything you were telling us about all the conflict within Sharia law, is that really any different than us? don't we have all of those same conflicts as well?
It's worse than us. It's much more, it's well, okay, your first question first. What does it mean? It means a bunch of different things to different people. If someone says they want to follow Sharia law, or someone claims to follow Sharia law in this day and age, it can mean a whole bunch of different things, depending on what exactly they think Sharia law is really all about. Some groups and some schools of thought, particularly derivatives of Wahhabi Islam, think that that means that the world has to follow Hanbali law. And everyone's got to follow Hanbali law, and following Sharia law entails, in part, making it so that the world follows Hanbali law. This is very extreme, and one way of thinking about it, and there are people who think that way. There are other people who think that following Sharia law means something like, I should be a good person. And that's what Sharia law is really all about. This is sort of the same kinds of issues we've had in the Jewish world for the last 200 years, which is the law, the rules still relevant? And should they still be observed, or are they getting at something deeper? And as long as you're observing the deeper stuff, then you're good. And so you have Muslims who think that following Sharia is about being a good person, and once I'm a good moral person, I can drink as much alcohol and eat as much pork as I like. And then you have everything else in between, very similar to what you might imagine exists in the Jewish world. You have people who are religiously scrupulous, and you have people who are less religiously scrupulous, people who follow this school of law or that school of law. Increasingly in the modern world, over the last 50 years or so, there's been a movement to kind of get away from the four schools of law and create a much more fluid modes of practice that draw on all four schools at once. Because the world is changing so fast and the schools are too rigid. So there's a variety of different stuff out there about what one might mean when they say, I want to follow or I do follow Sharia law. You'd have to know a lot more about them to get a better sense of kind of what they're really after and what they're really talking about. As far as the second question goes, yes, absolutely. one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is working with Muslim communities in the U.S. Figuring out how to do Islam in America. Because, primarily, they recognize that Jews have figured out how to do Judaism in America and do it well. And they're very curious about how we did this well. Part of that has to do with we've had a lot of trial and error and a long time to figure out how to do religion as a diaspora minority community, and this is something they're first grasping to do now. But one of the reasons this works and the conversations make sense and the things I tell them about Judaism and the kinds of mechanisms and institutions and strategies the Jewish community has used to make Judaism work and have continuity in America, it has resonance with them precisely because it sounds very similar. The dynamics of the community are very, very similar. There's all sorts of sectarian groups and cultural groups and social groups and ideological groups that are all vying for each other, and people belong to many of them at one time, and they're cross-cutting in all different kinds of ways. So it's very, very similar in that sense.
Thank you very much.